Hi. Now that you're here, we're all in the company of your cool aunts. I'm Sam.
And I'm Ted.
And this is the Your Cool Aunts podcast, where we follow the lives and times of cool aunts through Claire's diary. So welcome back. And if you're new here, thanks for stopping by, and be sure to hop on over to our website where you'll find all kinds of good stuff. All of Claire's diary, all of our podcasts. There's the boardroom where there's little
pictures. I always come up with the pictures. Pictures, photos.
Yeah, it sort of rounds things up and
positive things to make your life better.
Exactly. So
how are you today?
I am well. I am well. Everybody out there is doing well. Life is good. Claire has sent us another diary entry, as is her usual. And where did she leave off? I'm trying to remember where we left off with her.
Well, last time she was on her way to speak to her aunt or to her mom, to Barrett or to Laurent.
Right.
They told her to do.
Grace said, you'll probably want to go speak to Laurent. No, talk to Barrett first and give her this code word. And
what's the code word? I bet you people out there don't remember the code word.
I don't remember.
Seller files.
Oh, the seller files. Yeah,
Seller files is our code word.
So they could feel free to speak to her.
Mm-hmm.
Which is kind of weird because you have somebody with her daughter having to use a code word.
Well,
all right. Well,
we'll find out why soon.
Okay. So Claire needs more information and she's going to talk to her mother and her aunt. And this is where we left off. So we're good?
Yep. Let's get started.
Okay, here we go. Now, interestingly, Claire is not giving us a note on this. It's just, she's just continuing on where she left off, right?
Yeah. Well, it's okay. I mean, she's already told us what
we know
need
where
to
we are.
Know.
She needs more information.
She needs more information.
Okay. Claire starts off, "The next morning, I did something I almost never do. I didn't get up right away. I stayed in bed, staring out the window. And I could see Grace and Sid sitting outside having their coffee and talking. Claire always gets up early. Grace never gets up early."
Maybe the seller files has changed her life. Right?
Somebody's feeling a little nervous. So Claire picks up and says exactly what I just said. She said, "I don't think Grace has ever gotten out of bed earlier than me. And I wondered if she was as out of sorts as I was feeling. I had reached the point where I started to plan how and when I'd get hold of Barrett so I could talk to her about all of this arrangement," she says, "with Sid and Grace. So I stopped for a second to check myself." And she asks herself, "Did that really happen yesterday?" You know, she asked Grace when they were talking,
she did say
"Are you punking me?"
Yeah,
is this,
yeah.
You know, she did.
What is this thing you're
doubt
doing
the
me?
Reality of this circumstance, right? "Did this really happen yesterday?" She goes on, she says, "This wasn't one of those too realistic dreams, or was it?" Mm. So she's lying in bed saying, "Did this all happen?" Anyway, she says, "I remember asking Grace the same thing yesterday. No, it wasn't a dream, Claire. And the fact that Grace is up before you should be confirmation enough." Okay.
Something is afoot.
Point well taken. I'll try to hold back on my comments because I seem to make a comment before Claire gets a chance to say it. The next section, she just puts a little scribble in here and she says, "A long wait. I dressed and waited for Barrett to come inside from her garden. Cha was guarding her nearly full picking basket, so I knew she wouldn't be that much longer. Everything felt clandestine, and I wasn't sure whether to laugh or cry. A series of questions continued to cycle through my mind as I waited. Should I feel excited about my business prospects or fearful about Grace's proposal? What else is there? Am I clueless or merely outside of a loop? Oh, and by the way, we're talking about my mother and her sister. What was I going to say when Barrett finally came inside? Would my posture be to join them in this adventure or to convince them to distance themselves from it? I don't know if everyone appreciates the risks involved in this business. And I'm not at all confident that I know half of it either. This state of mind is exhausting. Too many questions. Never enough information to make a decision that would give me any degree of confidence. This lack of confidence fuels an endless list of questions and hypothetical scenarios. It feels crazy making to me, and to top it all off, when I checked the time again, I'd only been waiting for about 5 minutes.
Well, it appears as though
She's buzzing.
She's doing a lot of thinking about what is it? What's her involvement in it? But more importantly, how come, you know, she's so close to her aunt and to her mom? Why didn't she know? Why didn't she have an inkling about this? I think that's what's really blowing her mind.
I wonder if she feels betrayed in a way. Like, why haven't they told? Oh, left out anyway. Hmm. Left out is
left
probably
out.
More.
Yeah.
Any other thoughts?
Well, the other thing I think is, you know, most of the time you think you're so close to somebody that you do know everything, and then again, this shows us that not
even
necessarily.
More so when you're talking about, mm-hmm. you know, like in a mother-daughter relationship. Now it's an adult relationship, and yeah, I think Claire felt that, you know, she really knew pretty much everything, and then turns out she didn't.
Yeah. Well, you know, getting back to that mother-daughter thing that you were talking about a second ago, I think as it relates to mother-daughter relationships, I think daughters tend to think they know more about their mothers than they really do.
Yeah. Yeah.
But just an aside for all those daughters out there who think they know everything about
their moms. Your
mother
has not told you everything. She has a life.
Yeah. And had a life before you got here. So.
Oh, that.
Yeah. Anyhow, let us not digress.
Do not press your mother for too many details. Okay. So Claire was buzzing out thinking about all of this. She's waiting for Barrett, and then she realizes she's only been waiting for 5 minutes, so she's really in a twist. So I'll continue. Claire says, "My career in the wine business has been relatively short-lived so far. Nearly every day I talk to people who are fourth, fifth, and sixth generation farmers and vintners, which makes my little starter decade feel minuscule in comparison." Hang on a second. I wonder where Claire's going. She just kind of changed gears. I guess this is her mind wandering.
Yeah, I think this is what happens when you look inside Claire's head.
Okay, well, we're just following along here. Okay. Claire says, "The farming and the winemaking is easy to be drawn into. The beauty of the vineyards, the history permeates everything, the stories of family-owned properties, the survival legends, and especially the against-all-odds success stories. I've always been particularly drawn to the histories, the stories and legends of the women who refused to give up, who refused to surrender. Somehow, they found a seed of energy to get back out into that field or the cellar and start over. Their history has inspired me since my first summer as a cellar tour guide, when I pulled the minds of tourists back into the history of the champagne houses as we walked through the chilly, damp cellars."
Oh, well, I can feel the coldness now. Let me give a shiver right now.
No one ever believes how cold it is down in those cellars. It's 58 degrees and it's wet.
Yeah, it's very wet.
I mean, you're not up to your knees in water, but there's water down there. There's wet walls. The chalk is always usually wet.
But I think what she says earlier in that passage where she's talking about the survival legends, the survival stories of these women, and I think it, you know, can apply to a lot of different women in terms of surviving.
Yeah, I think she's really intrigued by the history. There's a real comeback quality to the region and the people there. They've gone through natural disasters, political, you know, the wars, all of that, and they keep coming back. No matter what it is, they come back. And, you know, she's really inspired by that.
I'm just thinking of what she was told. Cellar files is the code, but she was a cellar tour guide. So the cellar thing keeps coming up. Anyhow, go ahead.
Okay, let's move along here. So Claire's kind of going back in time, thinking about her career and what inspires her here and everything. Okay, let's follow her. And she says, "For 3 bucolic summers, I returned to the village between Reims and Epernay. I lived with the Greneaux family on their relatively small plot vineyard, and I worked along the vineyard rows in the early mornings and later in the day descended into the cellars for those tours. I extended my last internship summer through to the end of the year, mostly to participate in the harvest and pressing weeks through the early autumn. I count those additional few months as at least as valuable as my entire college education and the best life decision I've ever made thus far. As valuable as they may have been, it was a mere blink of a moment in the world of wine. I'd seen and participated in all of the steps, from vine to bottle to cellar. You know, when you think about it, she really did. She was out in the vineyard, weeding, plucking, pulling, whatever. But she never harvested. She was there up until, and then that last summer she stayed through for the harvest, right?
She talks about all of the components of making wine and how she has been intimately involved in all of that, from, you know, growing the grapes and tending to the vineyards, to talking to people about the wine in the cellar tours. And I think she has had an additional experience in doing that, because tourists come and they listen to these stories, but they're not really invested, you know? I mean, they're just there taking a tour and getting a glass of champagne at the end of the tour. She really got into it. Wasn't just a job for her, as it might have been for some people.
Well, she was living it.
She was living it, right, exactly.
Well, anyway, here we go. So Claire did everything from vine to bottle to cellar. And now she's...
to sale.
To cellar, C-E-L-L-A-R, to cellar, S-E-L-L-A-R, right?
Yeah.
Or buyer, whichever. Okay, so let's follow Claire here. She says, it wasn't until I'd been in the business of bulk purchasing that I realized how much of the intrigue and the value happens after a label is affixed and the boxes are sealed. And she says, I compare it to the ballet. Think of a major ballet company's performance of a well-known story like Swan Lake. Everyone is excited to attend. They're dressed to the nines and all pinned up, as they say. The cast is trained. They're ready. This would be the point where the wine is bottled and labels are affixed, orders taken, and cases stacked. After the performance, the dressing rooms are dark. There's nothing in common with the performance, the beauty of it all, or the art. This is where human behavior happens in all of its glorious and inglorious ways, where the politics, investor money, preferred access, and the egos of men and women play out. It isn't always a negative thing, but it's never meant to be seen, as it would destroy the story and the mystique of the ballet and the wine, too. This is why tour guides will never say how many bottles of champagne are produced in their house. It would devalue the story. So
you don't need to see how the sausage is made. You just need to eat the sausage.
Or the wine.
Or the wine, for that matter.
Well, yeah.
But this is applicable to anything, though. When you think about the work you put into writing something or making something.
Right.
And then you see the finished product. And you say, oh, isn't that pretty? And it's like, it's a moment, right? But you don't see how many moments it took to get it to that point.
Well, even, you know, when they talk about movie making and it takes months and months of filming to produce an hour and a half of, you know, final edit or
colorizing or music or, all the components that go into it. And it's the same with wine. It's the same with anything.
Well, the thing with the wine is the whole premise of champagne is it's a luxury product and you can't have too much out there. Or it's not so luxury. That's the general perception. So anyway, Claire continues. She says, this is definitely not a unique phenomenon, not by a long shot. I think it would be fair to say that concerning almost anything perceived as luxury, be it a performance, competition, product or service, the behind the scenes activities, the before parts where the investment happens, is where people can get entangled in the ugliest behaviors. The ones I associate with disappointment, or worse, injured egos. The settings and the gear vary widely, from horse shows to the theater, a fine leather atelier, couture labels, and of course, wine cellars. All are repositories of fine art and performance, dedicated artisans and athletes. There's only one thing in common, the substantial amounts of money held by those who are neither the makers or the doers. Their money gives access not to just the outcome or product, but to the status. And therein lies the greatest value, status. This is what the women of Champagne learned very early as they developed the first marketing strategy for luxury goods. Selling champagne to the Russian Tsar was brilliant. Of course, everyone wants to drink the same wine as the Tsar drinks. The Veuve Clicquot and Madame Pommeret, the resilient, brilliant women of Champagne. Okay, so there are a few great books out there that speak to the widow Clicquot. Was that the name
yes.
of the book?
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, there's a few really good ones that really give you all the deep story or somewhat deep story of where and how this got going. But how the Veuve Clicquot, how she, you know, her husband died and she had this entity and she just pushed forward and force of will made it happen. And brilliance, too.
I think it's interesting when you talk about these women who inherited, like Pommeret, inherited these champagne houses and what they did to move the product along. And like you mentioned about Veuve Clicquot, in the mid-level war, she was making sure that the Russian Tsar got her product.
Yeah, I think...
in the mid-level war, can you imagine?
I remember reading that she risked all of her inventory. It was packed in... these bottles are packed in straw and baskets. That's how they shipped it, straw and basket. And they sent it off to Russia, like through the war region, to get to the Tsar.
Yep.
And it worked.
And the company's still here, which tells us something. But yeah. I think the ability of women to be resourceful and to think through to the next level they wanted to take their product. And, you know, we see these as like, you know, they're oddities, but they really aren't. You know, if women do get the opportunity, they sometimes, in many instances, be better than the person who initially had the company.
Yeah, yeah. I don't think we'd be talking about the Clicquot Champagne if it weren't for the Veuve, the widow.
Right. And well, even today in Champagne, the number of women who, you know, who run these champagne houses like Krug, you know, there are quite a few women who are still in the business.
Yeah, it's a cool history.
Yeah.
In that way.
Maybe we'll talk about Krug at some point. Maggie is her name. Anyway.
Well, I think it's similar with some of the liqueurs, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. Sidetrack. The resilient, brilliant women of Champagne. I love that line. Okay. Claire continues. Remember the old saying that the ultimate form of flattery is imitation? Well, this holds true in the business of all wines and spirits, and overall, it's a good thing in a very limited ways. The 18th century women of Champagne understood this as well. They used it as the basis of desire and therefore value. But they also knew enough to prevent copies, because the temptation to imitate is accompanied by greed and ignorance, and their wines would ultimately suffer from resultant poor quality of the imitations. They devalued the copies by deploring every method to make a bottle of champagne unique. Elaborate labels, bottle capping with wax seals, numbering systems, and on and on. Their methods gradually found their way onto all sorts of luxury goods 50 or 150 years later. Luxury goods became the other currency and symbols of power. The practice of authentication has become a place for science and technology, security and intrigue, too. Did I mention ego and money, loss and humiliation, or mystery and danger?
My goodness. What is she telling us?
Okay,
here?
I think now I'm understanding where she's going with all this. So Claire says, making a copy to imitate is far different from making copies for profit. Forgeries are not intended as a complement to the original. Theft of value by forgery has always been associated with the underworld. Why then is it called only a knockoff when it's a fake watch or a designer handbag, as though it isn't all that bad? Branded clothing and sneakers for sale out of boxes on sidewalks are common occurrences, yet we think nothing out of it. The expensive handbag for only $50, also available from a sidewalk vendor. It's not a big deal anymore. We laugh it off and forgive ourselves by saying that no one takes it for the real thing. The sidewalk hawkers are only trying to make a living too. It gets very serious when the values are much higher and the products in question are limited. Every symbol of success and power is a rich target for a counterfeiter. The world of wine and spirits produces an almost unlimited supply of targets. Acclaimed antique vintages supposedly discovered, she puts in air quotes, discovered, somewhere buried in a cellar or in the remains of a sunken ship, and so rare it cannot be made available for public auction. This is not the more usual forgery story, though. Stories that appeal to greed, getting an amazing deal, or the first shot at something. Every wine forgery story that makes its way into the public forum is almost comical for the plain old greed it appeals to. It's the stories that are never known that are the most interesting, and this is where Grace and Sid excel, making difficult or embarrassing things go away.
Did they tell her more than she's letting on here?
Yeah, I guess.
I don't know. What is she telling us? All these messages. What is this?
I do not know.
Like, what do they excel in? And well, I obviously she knows a little bit more than she's telling us right now. But I think it's interesting when she talks about this whole issue of forgery and counterfeiting. And why is it that we think of a bag that's sold on the street as not a big deal?
Well,
when
I think
in fact it is a big deal.
Yeah, I think when it's widely done, it's like, so what? It's not a big deal. Nobody believes that's a Rolex. You're not going to buy a Rolex for $10.
Right.
Or a Lacoste shirt or Peshmina scarves.
Yeah, but the person who's looking at that Rolex watch on someone's wrist doesn't know how much it costs. They don't know the backstory of how they got it, right? They just think this is somebody walking down the street with a Rolex. They don't know the circumstances.
Well,
right?
Yeah. I mean, people always want to be more than they are or have more than they do. I mean, many people, I shouldn't say everyone. Yeah, I think we perceive it as harmless when it's common. When it's a common act, so what, you know, nobody believes that's real, you know. You can tell because it doesn't have, you know, the bezel that a Rolex has, you know, the up-close details that right. differentiate. But there's a pretty good knockoffs out there. They've got good at it.
But she says making a copy to imitate is far different from making copies for profit.
Well, to imitate is not to pass yourself off as the original.
Right.
Right? To imitate is to say, hey, this person or this company does that well. Let's try to do it that way, you know, because it's popular or it's just well done, be it a fashionable color or a certain cut of cloth. It can be anything. But when you do it and try to make it look like this is from that company or person, the maker, you know.
Yeah, but I think we have this idea of dupes. I mean, when you go on Instagram or any of the other platforms and you see these people who say, hey, I found these dupes, right? These dupe hauls.
Oh, well, this is a whole...
And that's
a whole other kettle of fish.
Yeah.
I think you told me recently that after a fashion show, it's now measured in hours, the time it takes to, you know, say there's a dress, you know, a knee length, very pretty floral dress, I don't know, whatever it is. Within hours, it's cut and made.
Right.
So they look at it on the runway. Somebody's getting, you know, people know how to, you know, construct a garment and they make a pretty close copy of it. Yeah. It's cheap cloth. It's, you know, not great tailoring, obviously. They whack it off and they copy it quickly and then it's out there.
Yeah. Well, when you think about back in the old days before the internet, you had to go to the show and wait for Vogue or some other magazine to pick it up.
Right? Well, it was a slow moving wave, though. You know, this is what they showed in Paris.
Yeah.
And then 6 months later, that trend will right. show up in manufacturing, maybe a year later sometimes.
Right.
But that trend, a hemline or the leg width of a pair of slacks, whatever it is, eventually turns up in ready to wear. And
now the show is on the internet as it's happening, and there are people sketching and making the garment, a knockoff of the garment within hours.
Okay, so is that theft? Is that imitation? Because, they did it beautifully. Let's make a floral dress similar to what we just saw on the runway. Or is it, they made that dress, we're going to copy it, we're going to get it out there, and maybe you can wear this and be perceived as wearing something that just came off the runway.
Right, right.
I think it's done for the latter purpose.
Yeah, I think so too. Yeah, you can have it. But the speed in which that's done now is very different than what it used to be. And what
nuts,
just to bring it back to the champagne issue, you can't make a grape grow any faster than it's going to grow. Right. So when you think about going back to
the raw material aspect.
The raw material aspect of wine, the difference there is the grape has to grow. right? And then you go through the process, and then eventually the bottling and how it's bottled and all the rest of it. It's not an overnight theft issue at the beginning. I mean, for the production process of it, right? But when it becomes wine, that's when.
Well, I recently saw a piece about they tracked a bottle that ultimately turned out to be a counterfeit of a Bordeaux wine. And that this particular bottle, it was a Pommeray, like famous vineyard. And this particular bottle, it was from like the 1950s, I think, had changed hands about 15 or 16 times. And along the way, grew in price. Somebody held it for a year, somebody held it for 20 years, somebody held it for 6 months, you know, on and on. And this was, you know, I have this. And nobody would ever know what's in there. It's right. The bottle, it's the label, it looks right. We have all kinds of expertise that weighs in on verifying these things, yeah. But you never know until you get in the bottle. So, yeah. Okay.
So all that to say,
imitation versus counterfeit.
Right. And how much more difficult it is when we're dealing with issues such as wine or champagne and how it comes to be.
Well, it's I can see I'm nearing the end of this diary entry, but we got a little bit to go here. And anything else before I continue? No, you good?
No, I'm good.
All right. Okay, so Claire continues. She says, every once in a while, Grace threatens to write a tell-all memoir, but then she seems satisfied to tell a few fictionalized stories instead. I love her storytelling and always knew enough not to ask for too much detail. There were times she would leave a few too many crumbs, though, just enough to let me figure out who the celebrity in trouble might have been. That was fun. But now, this, what they're doing, is altogether a very different thing. And right now, it involved a substantial part of my family, too. I needed more detail before I spoke with either Laurent or my mother. So I decided not to wait for Barrett. I changed direction and headed for the terrace. I could see Sid alert Grace that I was on my way, and they both seemed to straighten up in their seats. Sitting down, I drew a breath to speak, but Sid beat me to the punch. And this is a quote from Sid. She said, I think we owe you some explanations, as in how it all started. And that's it. That's all she gives
us. That's it.
You know, Claire's starting to like leave us hanging.
That's it.
With some frequency lately, I might add.
Wow. So what have we learned?
So where are we? What have we learned? Where is she leaving us?
Well, I guess she still has to go talk to her mom and Laurent. But first,
They're
going to give her more information.
So what has she done here? She was going to speak to her mother, and then she went on this sort of accounting. Then she went on this like memory tour of her involvement in wine and the business and counterfeiting and when it's an imitation versus a counterfeit for profit and all that can be involved in that and egos and greed and, you know.
But you do get a little bit of, she knew about these other stories, right? So when Grace was working in the PR business, she would, you know, there'd be some stories she would tell.
Yeah, some celebrity got, you know, mixed up in something stupid.
But never did she know about this part of the business.
Well, we don't.
She said Grace would threaten to write or had mentioned that she wanted to write a memoir about these people she had worked for. And
yeah,
now
she just tells fictionalized versions of the story. So,
yeah. So we know Grace was involved in something in the past.
Well, hang on a second. All Claire knows at this point is, I'll leave it there.
You can't just leave it there. I guess you are.
I don't know what Claire knows. All right. Well, let me just do a little overview here because I'm a little confused.
Okay.
At the beginning of this diary entry, Claire is going to wait for Barrett to ask her some questions about what is this cellar files thing? What's going on here? And she starts thinking about it. She's very wound up in it. She's a million questions. And during this, she recounts for us all of her experience in the wine business and then the behind-the-scenes aspect, the history of it, the greed, the counterfeiting, all of these things involved. And Grace is in the business in PR of fixing people's problems, right?
Right.
So obviously Grace has some involvement in this as it relates to what Claire's doing. So here we are, and Claire decides, no, before I talk to them, I'm going to go back. I've got some more questions before I talk to Barrett and Laurent. So off she goes.
Right.
And before she even says anything, they know she has more questions to say, wait a minute, we owe you an explanation, right?
Right. That's where they kind of leave us hanging for another episode, right?
Claire, this is going to be work.
But it's interesting.
So I think, the next time we hear from Claire, we're going to finally know what they're speaking about, right?
Hopefully.
Yeah, okay. All right, I'm with you on that one.
It's getting interesting. I must say, there's a little interesting tidbit about the direction she's taking us in with these diary entries that she hadn't done before, which is, it seems like there's more to it, right? It's not just an isolated story. It seems to be, or an isolated entry. It seems to be a continuation of sorts with this new venture.
Yeah.
Whatever this venture is. I'm not quite sure. I guess that's why I tune in every week. But anyway, let us not digress.
Oh, man. Okay. Well, anyway, we'll be back with more from Claire.
Yeah, I think we should start a campaign and send Claire questions.
Well, let's let Claire tell us in her own time and in her own way.
Okay.
All right, then. Okay, well, come on back in the meantime. Okay, then. Well, if you haven't, subscribe so you don't miss the next episode when Claire finally tells us what's going on.
Tell your friends.
Subscribe on the website, and we'll send it directly to your inbox so you don't have to think about it. We're on every podcast platform out there. So we'll see you next time when we're
back at the mic.